This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, May 11th, 2009. In Cairo, I'm Aya Batraoui, sitting in for Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, a U.S. soldier kills five of his colleagues in Baghdad today. And we head to a camp in Pakistan where thousands of people are seeking refuge from fighting in the north. And a Michigan journalist faces up to 4 years in prison after being arrested while covering a high-speed chase on Election Day. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The United Nations says today a weekend artillery attack in northern Sri Lanka that killed hundreds of civilians was the bloodbath it had feared in the continued fighting between the army and Tamil Tiger rebels. Free Speech Radio News' Punia Manikavasagam has the story.
United Nations spokesperson Gordon Weiss said over 100 children were among the dead. The rebels, along with medical professionals in the war zone, say the army fired artillery shells into a no-fire area demarcated by the government for the safety of civilians in the conflict zone. The government has denied the charges, claiming it was the rebels who fired heavy weapons in the civilian areas and then blamed the government forces. Civil officials serving in the war zone say hundreds of dead bodies of civilians were seen scattered all over the roads in makeshift houses and trenches. Dr. Thuraiyaraja Varadaraja is the top medical officer in the war zone.
Last 48 hours we received 1,347 casualties and 433 dead bodies. According to the civilian report, there are more than 1,000 dead the last 48 hours.
The army says the rebels have been confined to a tiny bit of land and the operation is intended to rescue thousands of civilians held hostage by the rebels to slow down the army's advance. But the rebels say they were not using civilians as human shields. For FSRN, Ponnaiya Manikavasagam in Vavuniya, Sri Lanka.
Shocked by the news of yesterday's escalating violence in Sri Lanka, last night Toronto's Tamil community took to the streets by the thousands. Free Speech Radio News' Aaron Lakoff.
On Sunday evening, an estimated 2,000 members of Toronto's Tamil community blocked the city's Gardiner Expressway, one of Canada's busiest stretches of highway, to demand that the Canadian government intervene in the worsening situation in Sri Lanka. Shortly after 7 p.m., a crowd consisting of adults, children, and the elderly defied police lines and marched up the on-ramp of the Gardiner, completely shutting down traffic in both directions until well after midnight. Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair characterized the action as unsafe and unlawful, while the crowd remained peaceful and no one was hurt. In the end, the demonstrators decided to disperse after Canadian Leader of the Opposition, Michael Ignatieff, agreed to bring up their concerns in a caucus meeting in Ottawa today. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN.
Defense Secretary Robert Gates today asked for the resignation of the top U.S. military leader in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, saying the move was in the interest of national security. Last week's U.S. airstrikes in Afghanistan's western province of Farah stirred protests around Afghanistan. According to Afghan officials, as many as 140 civilians were killed. The U.S. government has rejected these numbers, angering many, and increasing calls to end the U.S. airstrikes. Asma Namadi reports from Kabul.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai's call to end airstrikes was met with a bleak rejection from White House National Security Advisor James Jones, noting that it would be irresponsible to cease the airstrikes altogether. Jones also said that the U.S. military will do its utmost to ensure that civilians are not killed. The U.S. military continues to lose support amongst the Afghans. Malala Joya, an outspoken and elected member of the parliament from Farah province, is also calling for an end to the airstrikes. Joya asked for further investigation in the number of the killed civilians. Doctors who have been treating the wounded from last week's U.S. airstrikes have also noted strange burns on their patients. Along with several American and Afghan investigations underway, Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission is looking into the possible usage of white phosphorus in the attacks, a chemical that usually leaves a yellowish color on burned skin. White phosphorus, which is used to light up the night sky, is allowed under certain circumstances in the Chemical Weapons Convention, and the U.S. military does use it. However, this usage is only permitted outside of civilian areas. The U.S. military has denied using white phosphorus. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Asma Namadi reporting from Kabul.
Roxana Sabiri, the American-Iranian journalist convicted in Iran of spying for the United States, has been released from jail. Sabiri has consistently denied the charges. Her father, Reza Sabiri, says she will not leave the country today, but will do so in the very near future.
She is in good condition, and we are very happy that they gave us such a break.
Sabiri's 8-year sentence was overturned on appeal. The Iranian court reduced her sentence to 2 years and suspended the balance in what they called a gesture of Islamic mercy. Attacks by Maoist militants continue to overshadow the ongoing national elections in India. In yet another deadly strike last night, the rebels killed 13 in the central state of Chhattisgarh. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Authorities say more than 150 heavily armed militants attacked a 40-member police team late Sunday night when they were on their way to the state's Kankar district for a search operation. The militants first blew up the police vehicle with a landmine and then opened indiscriminate fire, killing 12 policemen and a civilian. This is the second Maoist attack in Chhattisgarh in less than a week and the deadliest since the beginning of India's general elections. The Maoists have called for a boycott of the polls and have intensified their attacks on security forces. More than 35 people have been killed since voting began on April 13th. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
A U.S. soldier has shot dead 5 of his colleagues at a base in the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. The Pentagon says at least 2 other people were hurt in the shootings and the gunman is in custody. Details are still coming in, but the incident reportedly happened at a stress clinic where troops get help for personal issues or combat stress. Aaron Glantz has more.
At an afternoon press conference, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates was tight-lipped about the details of the shooting, the first such spree by a U.S. soldier through 6 years of war in Iraq.
We're still in the process of gathering information on exactly what happened, but if the preliminary reports are confirmed, such a tragic loss of life at the hands of our own forces is a cause for great and urgent concern.
A military statement said the shooting took place around 2 p.m. local time in the mental health clinic at Camp Liberty, a sprawling base next to Baghdad International Airport. The Pentagon said the names of the dead soldiers were being withheld pending family notification. The name of the shooter was also not released. Veterans advocates say the details of the incident will be critical in assessing whether the killings could have been prevented. Paul Sullivan is executive director of Veterans for Common Sense.
We need to know if this soldier was examined by a physician before or after deployment, and if any mental health symptoms were observed. We know from repeated congressional investigations and hearings that the military has knowingly sent soldiers with physical and mental health diagnoses and severe symptoms back to the war zone. In some of those cases, the service members killed themselves or others.
More than 230 active duty soldiers, airmen, and Marines committed suicide last year, the highest military suicide statistic in nearly 30 years. In January, more American soldiers killed themselves than were killed by the enemy in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. In November 2006, a New York National Guardsman was arraigned in a military court on charges of murdering 2 officers in an explosion at one of Saddam Hussein's former palaces. The series of incidents leads some observers to recall the military's internal meltdown during the Vietnam War.
In December of 72, the Defense Department acknowledged that somewhere between 800 and 1,000 officers had actually been blown up by their subordinates.
Vietnam War widow Penny Coleman is author of the book Flashback, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, Suicide, and the Lessons of War. Back then, the killings were called fragging because fragmentation bombs were usually used.
And the fragmentation devices were the weapon of choice because they left no evidence. There obviously were no fingerprints. There were, there was no way of tracking it.
Iraq war veterans watched the news come in with a mixture of shock, outrage, and resignation.
I was in pod B of the Manhattan VA hospital when I heard this, with other veterans waiting, and we're just shaking our heads.
Former U.S. Army Captain Luis Carlos Montalvan received two Purple Hearts for wounds sustained during his two tours in Iraq. He said many of his fellow veterans felt a mix of irony and horror that while they were waiting for hours to receive government health care stateside, their active duty counterparts were being killed by one of their own in a clinic in the war zone.
Horrifying that there were men and women in a combat stress center at Camp Liberty who were going to seek help, and now the relatives, back home, who thought that their loved ones were okay and that they were going to, get treatment, are now dead. They went and they're dead. They were in a mental health facility and they were killed there. Can you imagine the grief?
The Pentagon press conference this afternoon, the head of Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mike Mullen, said the military's investigation will include an examination into the number of tours the suspect had served in Iraq and whether he had been deployed to the war zone despite an earlier mental health diagnosis. For FSRN, I'm Aaron Glantz.
The Pakistani military continued its assault on Taliban militants in the mountainous Swat Valley today and claims to have now killed some 700 militants. The violence has caused one of Pakistan's largest internal migrations, with the UN estimating more than 360,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. In the first part of a two-part series, FSRN's Catherine Comp reads for our correspondent in Pakistan, Gabe Matthews, who went to an internally displaced persons camp in the northwest frontier province.
Dozens of women and children from Swat arrived by truck at the Jalala refugee camp. Most of these women have never left their villages, especially without their husbands. They lack confidence walking among men and even talking. Some women and children are sitting under the open sky, waiting to register with camp officials. They left home in a hurry to save their lives and arrived here with nothing. They left behind animals, farm fields, and their few prized possessions, like jewelry and clothes. Many also came without their sons, who stayed behind to harvest the fields. Gulmina is one of them. She's an 80-year-old who reached the camp after 6 hours. She walked here, barefoot.
I was on a prayer mat when the shelling started. It was horrible. I have 3 sons left and a cow. I'm worried about everyone but my cow. I don't think I'll be able to get back. My cow is my whole life savings. It was for my funeral expenses and it's my whole life's earnings. I tried to stay in my house long enough so that I could take my cow with me, but my son forced me to leave when the shelling got really bad. I can't forget my pregnant cow.
Gulmina had 6 children, but 3 of them were killed when her house was hit by shelling during a fight between the military and Taliban militants. Not far from Gulmina, Shami Roshan is sitting and talking to herself. She looks like she's almost 90 years old. She says she doesn't know her exact age, but she does remember a happy life decades ago under British rule.
I left only God behind in my home. My only son, he sent me away and did not come with me. He wanted to stay behind to take care of the house. It was raining debris. We came here because we feared for our lives. I am living a life I never imagined. I have nothing. It is the worst point in my life. I pray for a peaceful solution.
At the entrance gate of the camp, 5-year-old Wakas Khan sits in his father's rickshaw, which they used to get here from Swat. With his mother close by, Wakas holds tight to a chicken and 2 hens. This is all the family owns.
I love my chickens and hens, so I made my dad bring them with us. There was bombing and shelling everywhere. We had to run for our lives.
Most of these displaced people are poor and have reached the camp after walking 5 to 6 hours. Many don't even have shoes. To finish the journey, some had to pay drivers with what little money they had. Others were stopped by militants on their way. According to the UN and Pakistani government, around 500,000 people are expected to migrate out of Sawat. Around 70,000 are already registered in 3 IDP camps. Reading for Gabe Matthews at the Jalala IDP camp, I'm Catherine Kamp, FSRN.
President Obama is claiming success on the first stage of health care reform, cost reduction. Interested parties that range from doctors to health insurance providers to pharma to the labor union SEIU have pledged to reduce $2 trillion in health care costs over the next decade, an estimated savings of $2,600 per family, according to the administration.
This is a historic day, a watershed event in the long and elusive quest for health care reform. And as these groups take the steps they are outlining, and as we work with Congress on healthcare reform legislation, my administration will continue working to reduce healthcare costs to achieve similar savings by curbing waste, fraud, and abuse, and preventing avoidable hospital readmissions, and taking a whole host of other cost-saving steps. We can save billions of dollars while delivering better care to the American people.
The administration hasn't released the details of the cost-saving measures. The Obama administration also announced today increased enforcement of antitrust laws. It's a reversal from the Bush administration's policy, which said antitrust enforcement would stifle competition and innovation. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
Christine Varney, head of the antitrust division at the Justice Department, announced sweeping changes to U.S. antitrust policy.
As antitrust enforcers, we can no longer sit on the sidelines.
Varney says the U.S. has failed to enforce antitrust law in the last decade under the guise that it stifles market competition and curtails innovation. Just last year, the Bush administration outlined a policy of non-enforcement in a Justice Department report.
We must change course and take a new tack.
Despite Bush-era arguments to the contrary, Varney expects increased competition, innovation, and consumer protection due to strict antitrust laws and a new policy on competition. Varney says she encourages companies to bring their complaints to the Justice Department, which will have adequate funds and resources to investigate claims and enforce the law. She also says courts should recognize the new emphasis on enforcement.
We must make sure that firms with market power continue to compete and that their efforts do not cross the line. Some dominant firms may need reminding that their right to compete aggressively remains qualified. When their conduct becomes predatory or unjustifiably exclusionary, the division will take action.
Because the U.S. has ignored antitrust law in recent years, many companies have taken their complaints to the European Union. The EU is expected to hand down a huge fine to Intel this week for violating antitrust law, just like Microsoft and IBM before them. Another long-running issue is Ticketmaster. Consumer advocate Bert Fohr runs the American Antitrust Institute in Washington, D.C. He says Ticketmaster is a prime example of how consumers are affected by large trusts.
Because everybody out there deals with the purchasing of tickets to a venue. And everybody out there, I believe, thinks that there's something funny going on and that monopoly power has a lot to do with it.
Without other options to buy tickets, people are forced to deal with Ticketmaster's customer service and convenience fees, which run up to $15 per ticket. Large companies from Microsoft to Ticketmaster to AIG have fought against tough enforcement. Andrew Pincus is a partner at the law firm Mayer Brown. He defends such companies.
The most important thing for businesses is to give them some understanding of what the rules of the road are going to be. I mean, the last thing we want are businesses paying a lot of money to law firms like mine to try and figure out whether what they're about to do or want to do or thinking about doing is going to comply with the policy, they should be spending that money on doing things that help the economy.
But Bert Fohr says the administration's focus on antitrust will be good for consumers.
I am not fearful. I'm very delighted to hear everything that I heard this morning from Christine.
Congress plans to debate legislation that will strengthen antitrust law as soon as this month. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
In Michigan, a community journalist is fighting a possible 4-year-long jail sentence after being arrested while covering a high-speed chase that ended in 2 fatalities on Election Day. When Diane Bukowski, a reporter for the newspaper The Michigan Citizen, arrived at the scene of the accident, she took some pictures and showed her press credentials. But what happened next is unclear. Bukowski says she was standing at least 70 feet from the dead bodies in an authorized area. Police say she was obstructing justice and suggested she was even standing in the blood of the victims. Police arrested her and confiscated her notebook and camera. A jury recently found Bukowski guilty of 2 counts of obstruction for crossing yellow police tape. FSRN spoke to Bukowski earlier today about her arrest, the trial, and what it all means.
Hi, Ms. Bukowski, I'd like to start off by asking you, why do you think you may have been targeted for arrest?
Well, I don't know for sure that I was targeted for arrest. I do know that I was targeted for excessive prosecution by Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy. I've done numerous stories on police brutality, on state trooper brutality, and also stories pinpointing Kim Worthy's failure to prosecute cops who kill and otherwise brutalize people in Wayne County.
And so then, do you think that your years of covering police brutality and police misconduct has led to, as you've called it, this excessive prosecution against you? Is this case basically, in your opinion, a politically motivated or possibly personally motivated case?
It's politically motivated, definitely. They're responding to the criticisms that not only myself on the Michigan Citizen, but other reporters and our editorial staff has had regarding Kim Worthy's actions in office.
But there's a contradiction, because it seems that from what you're saying, you didn't really do anything wrong. But then again, as you've said, and as we've seen, a jury did find you guilty of 2 counts. Why do you think that is?
I think it was because of the judge's instructions were challenging those as unconstitutional. It was because of a prosecutor's motion in limine to prevent the defense of press privilege, which totally limited my explanation of why I was there and what I was doing. And my jury was not representative of a fair cross-section of the community, as is guaranteed in the Sixth Amendment.
And Trooper Brierley has admitted to erasing 2 of the photos that you took at the scene of the crash. Why do you think he erased these pictures?
He said that he erased them so that the families would not be distressed by seeing them in print or on the internet. However, both families were there at the time I took the photos, and they have been very supportive of me.
And how has this entire experience and the trial affected you and personally affected your life and the way you go about your work as a journalist?
Well, actually, it has motivated me to be stronger and more resolved that justice is done not only in my case, but in, you know, thousands and thousands of other cases of people who have not had the advantages I have.
And lastly, what are your overall views of this trial? I mean, what do you think this is all about? What does it really come down to, in your opinion?
This is a serious attack. It represents a serious attack on the First Amendment, on the rights to a free press, on the right of the people of the city of Detroit and across the country to know what is really going on in their community. We're a black-owned newspaper that reports on issues that are of concern to black, to African-American citizens as well as poor citizens. The major news media does not cover most of these. Their effort is to intimidate, to put a chilling effect, as the ACLU said in their amicus brief in my case, on journalists who attempt to cover these issues.
That was Michigan-based reporter Diane Bukowski. Her sentencing is scheduled for June 1st. Her attorney has filed an appeal of the charges. Tuesday marks the one-year anniversary of the landmark immigration raid in Postville, Iowa. But a lot has changed in the last year. Tanya Snyder reports.
1 year ago, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents raided the agriprocessor's meatpacking plant in Postville. They detained 389 workers, most of them undocumented Guatemalan immigrants. Agriprocessors worker Humberto Nava spoke to a Gazette Online reporter the day after the raid.
They entered very aggressively. They pointed their guns at the people, and they shouted, "Don't run, because we're going to hunt you down like rats." They called us donkeys.
Fear settled over the community. Immigrant rights advocate Shuya Ono went to Postville within days of the raid.
About 300 families were holed up in the church because they were too scared to go home. And obviously, you know, the church with basically one bathroom. It felt like a war zone. It felt like a disaster.
He says government officials turned the cattle fairgrounds into a temporary holding facility and then turned the holding facility into a district court.
17, 18-year-old girls, young women would be chained, shackled together 10 at a time, brought into these hearings. And, you know, the judge would say things like, "Do you understand you waived all your rights to a jury? Do you understand you waived all your rights to appeal?" And I could tell just by looking at their faces that they had no idea what anybody was talking about.
Postville is a small town of about 2,000 people. Agriprocessors was the main employer, with more than 900 full-time workers. After the raid, criminal charges were filed against plant executives and the business went into bankruptcy. Now Agriprocessors employs only about 350 part-time workers. Residents say Postville has the feel of a ghost town. 3 months after the Postville raid made history as the biggest single-site workplace immigration raid in the United States, there was an even bigger one. In Laurel, Mississippi, ICE agents arrested nearly 600 undocumented workers. The raid coincided with Michelle Obama's speech at the Democratic National Convention and so received little press coverage. Big changes have taken place since the raids in Postville and Laurel. President Obama said as a candidate that he was against mass workplace raids, and his Secretary of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, announced 2 weeks ago that she was redirecting enforcement policy. She wants to go after employers that exploit undocumented workers. Scott Frotman of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union says it's a step in the right direction, but comprehensive reform is still needed.
I think going after bad employers is certainly one part, but you're never going to, you also need to address it comprehensively. You need to deal with legalization, family unification. And as the president has said, there's a lot of interconnected parts that go into addressing a broken immigration system.
A Supreme Court ruling last week determined that workers who give fake Social Security numbers can't be charged with felony document fraud if they didn't know they were using an actual number that belonged to someone else. That interpretation would have significantly lessened the sentences of the Postville workers. Since the majority of them have been deported, the ruling came too late to help them. On the Postville anniversary, immigrant rights advocates at 51 sites of ICE raids have joined together to call for an end to immigration raids. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. In Cairo, I'm Aya Batraoui, sitting in for Aura Bugado.